This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Lester Graham and for Cynthia Canty. On the program today, with apologies to Governor Snyder, a Bridge Magazine reporter outlines the real state of the state.
Higher poverty rates than the national average. Our schools lag behind most other states in performance. Those who get into college pay more for college than in other states.
We talk with a legal expert about sexual assault in sports and the Larry Nassar scandal.
I mean, this is arguably much worse than the Sandusky matter. I mean, we don't know, right? Both were really awful, but this appears to have many more victims.
There are more organ donors these days. Know why?
It's almost completely related to the opioid epidemic.
And then we get some ice fishing tips from an expert.
You go to the fish, don't let the fish come to you.
All that, plus we'll talk about college access for Detroit students. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham and for Cynthia Canty. The sentencing hearing of Larry Nassar continued today with more women and girls making victim impact statements. Listening to those survivors has been moving, it's been disturbing, and it's leading to more public outrage. Yesterday, the USA Gymnastics top board members resigned. Michigan State University President Luana Simon is being pressured to resign. And there are calls for reviews and investigations into how a sports doctor could sexually abuse girls and women for so long and no one was aware or willing to speak up. How could these adults in these institutions fail so many children? Some of this will be determined in the courts. Sports Illustrated ran a piece a few days ago looking at the legal implications. The author is SI's legal analyst, Michael McCann, and he joins me now. The first point you make is that Larry Nassar will be going to prison for a long, long time. He's already been sentenced to 60 years in prison for possessing child pornography. His plea deal would add to that. What else will Nassar face?
Well, he'll also face the potential, Lester, for additional charges. So we know that there's an investigation in Texas that could lead to new charges. The number of years that he ultimately is sentenced to could eclipse 200 years for all we know. So this is somebody who's going to spend the rest of his natural life in prison. In addition, he faces the possibility and most likely will at some point be assigned civil liability for what he did. And civil liability would reflect negligent and other forms of unlawful acts that he committed. In terms of civil liability, the punishment would be some kind of monetary award. But keep in mind, this is not somebody that likely has the financial wherewithal to pay any kind of substantial financial award. He has co-defendants in those lawsuits, including, of course, Michigan State and USA Gymnastics. They would likely have to foot most of any bill.
Right. And in your four-point article, your second point is USA Gymnastics and Michigan State University face this prospect of considerable liability. Both institutions have asked the lawsuits to be dismissed. On what grounds is MSU arguing for dismissal?
So MSU argues in part an argument based on something called sovereign immunity, which is a legal principle which says the government or branches of the government or government-funded entities like public universities are exempt from being sued unless they agree to be sued. Now, that's the general principle, and it's one that is true in every state, but in Michigan, as in other states, there are a bevy of exceptions. Some of those exceptions might apply here. Certainly, the plaintiffs in that lawsuit believe they apply. But Michigan State argues that none of the exemptions clearly apply here. And they are represented by Patrick Fitzgerald, of course, who played a prominent role in the prosecution of Scooter Libby, the Vice President Cheney's former chief of staff.
Also sent two Illinois governors to jail.
And sent two Illinois governors to jail. And it is a serious lawyer. This is Michigan State went for the big gun in terms of getting a lawyer. And it makes sense because the university knows that this is a litigation that not only could lead to many millions of dollars in damages for the school, it could also potentially lead to criminal charges for individual persons at the school. We know that with the Jerry Sandusky scandal at Penn State, it eventually led prosecutors to conclude that officials at the school not only were negligent, they were actually criminally responsible because of a gross failure to report crimes. And based on some of the allegations here, Nassar could have been raping or sexually assaulting women back in the mid to late 90s. And there were complaints that, as far as we can tell, were not acted upon in appropriate ways.
The next point you make is about non-disclosure agreements. We've heard a lot about non-disclosure agreements because of the allegations of sexual assault against Hollywood producer Harvey Weinstein. How is the topic of non-disclosure affected by this Larry Nassar case?
In that at least one person may appears to have signed a non-disclosure agreement with USA Gymnastics, and that would be Michaela Maroney, a retired Olympian gold medalist. She signed a non-disclosure agreement that said she can't talk about what occurred and can't defame the institution in any way. She now has a lawsuit out in California arguing that that clause is non-enforceable under California law because it's silencing a known victim of the serial sexual molester. So, you know, it's important here because non-disclosure agreements can silence those who have very valuable information to share. And that can prevent others from being victimized, because if somebody is bound by a non-disclosure agreement and then can't talk about what occurred, that allows the perpetrator to commit the same act again against somebody else. But the flip argument is that she knowingly signed the agreement. She was paid, according to the Wall Street Journal, $1.25 million. So she has a contractual obligation. It's hard because a lot of people don't like this idea that contracts can silence victims, but generally the law enforces those contracts.
Your fourth and final point is about the NCAA and whether Michigan State will see the kind of punishment Penn State did in the wake of the Jerry Sandusky scandal. What do you think the NCAA is likely to do?
Well, I think the NCAA has to be consistent. The NCAA got involved in the Sandusky matter in a way that was unprecedented, and the NCAA Constitution does offer very sweeping language in terms of institutional control. It clearly could apply that language to Michigan State, and if it's consistent with how it treated Penn State, it would impose some type of similar punishment, whether it's probation, postseason ban. Here, maybe the more relevant punishment would be a large fine. I think the NCAA has to do something. It can't simply say, well, you know, this isn't big-time football, so it's not to the same level of concern. I mean, this is arguably much worse than the Sandusky matter. I mean, we don't know, right? Both were really awful. But this appears to have many more victims, and I think a lot of people are going to say it can't be a situation where, well, it's not college football, it's not going to be a priority for the NCAA. The NCAA, I think, has to treat this with the same level of gravity as it has treated the Penn State matter and other similar occurrences.
Michael McCann is an attorney and the Associate Dean for Academic Affairs at the University of New Hampshire School of Law. He's also a legal analyst for Sports Illustrated. His recent article in SI is titled, Four Key Sports Law Implications of the Larry Nassar Scandal. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me on.
Photography is a hobby of mine, and occasionally that means trekking out to find wildlife. And earlier this winter, on one of those really, really cold days, I was at the Lake Erie Metro Park trying to track down snowy owls. No luck that day. But there were some winter enthusiasts who were having plenty of luck that day. There were several people ice fishing near the marina. Now, I've lived in Michigan 15 years, but I've never gone ice fishing, so I was interested when I saw that the Michigan Department of Natural Resources is looking for people who want to learn. It's offering ice fishing classes with expert anglers, such as my guest, Norm Smith. Hey, how's the fishing this winter?
Fishing's been great, and the ice has been great. That's the biggest plus here. In the last couple of years, it's been kind of iffy out there.
These Hardwater School ice fishing lessons are in Cadillac this Saturday and again on February the 24th. Who comes to these classes?
Well, just anybody that wants to learn how to improve their fishing skills or learn to be, you know, first-time ice fishermen. And we got special people, pros there, that'll teach them, you know, how to use electronics and tip-ups and jigging rods and anything that you want to learn on ice fishing is there.
Yeah, you're already way above my head on some of these terms. What kind of gear do I absolutely need to have to go ice fishing or to go to one of these classes?
Well, actually, you don't need anything to go to these classes because it's all supplied there.
No, it helps, yeah.
Yeah, well, except you need your warm clothing and gloves, you know, and boots and et cetera.
What kind of fish are you trying to catch?
Oh, I'm a panfish fisherman, crappie and bluegill, mostly in perch. Me and my wife both are avid pan fishermen.
What's the first thing you teach people? I mean, is it to drill the hole with an auger or how to use a line? Tell me an idea what we do.
Safety is the first thing we teach them. What to use in case you go through the ice, you know, ice picks to pull yourself out or carry ropes. And nowadays they have flotation suits. There's all sorts of precautions you want to take. And ice thickness, you know, what's safe and what's not. That's the first thing you teach them. And then you teach them how to get their gear ready to go out onto the ice. If you're going to go for panfish, you know, what size jigs do you use, what pound test lines, what size jigging rods and stuff like that.
I've seen some people out there on the ice in overalls, lots of layers out in the open. I've seen others in huddled up in shelters made out of tent material. What do you recommend?
Well, myself, I sit in a bucket out there pretty much. I'm not much of a shanty person. I've always been out in the elements, you know. I can withstand pretty cold weather. But shelters are great. You can go in there and they got flip-over shanties now. They got all sorts of different kinds of shelters you can use out on the ice now. And you put a heater in there, you can get right down to your shirt and blue jeans, you know, and fish pretty comfortably nowadays.
I'm wondering, you've been doing this for years. What do you find so fascinating about ice fishing?
Well, that's a pretty good question there. I like the people out on the ice, basically. A lot of times I'll just walk around and talk to the people, not even fish. I don't have too much of a problem catching fish. I've been doing it for years and years and years with my technique. It's a pretty aggressive way to catch fish.
If you were going to give somebody one piece of advice about ice fishing to be a successful ice fisher, what would it be?
To move around. Don't just stay in one spot. You find the weed beds out there on the ice or where everybody else is fishing. Don't sit in one hole. You go to the fish. Don't let the fish come to you.
Norm Smith is one of the fishing experts teaching ice fishing at the Carl T. Johnson Hunt and Fish Center in Cadillac this Saturday and again on February 24th. I hope you guys have a lot of cold weather and good ice and a lot of fun.
Well, thank you. We'll have a blast up there. And I recommend these classes. They're very educational, and you will learn how to catch fish. I'm not going to guarantee it, but you will learn how.
Coming up, one organization is trying to get more Detroit kids into college. We'll find out what's working and what challenges are still keeping many kids from obtaining a college degree. That's in 10 minutes, here on Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. Well, it's time for another edition of Theater Talk. David Kiley of Encore Michigan is here with a latest look at productions from professional theater companies all around the state. Let's start with a world premiere at the Matrix Theater in Detroit. What's going on there?
Well, they have a world premiere. It's a play called The Big Red Button. And this is a new play by author Michael Perry Jr., who's an actor, writer, and director. He's originally from Baltimore. He works primarily in New York. And this play is interestingly inspired by a song, The Temptation of Adam by Josh Ritter. And it's a comedy about two people who have very different personalities, and they're learning to connect as they sit in an underground bunker awaiting instructions about the final missile during World War III. So it's a bit timely, given the state of tensions, I'd say, between U.S. and North Korea. I think he probably was working on the play before those escalated. But I'd say the timing is pretty on the nose. I spoke with the director of this play, Luna Alexander, this week about this new play and why she was attracted to the project.
I think that the script offers us a lovely little opportunity to kind of chuckle at the differences between two people of opposite genders, especially when they're in an enclosed space. But at the end of the day, this is a play about human empathy, right, and personal responsibility. So if we were faced with a situation where you or I might have to, you know, hit a blinking red button or swipe something on a screen that might potentially wipe out life as we know it, most of us are pretty quick to say, you know, I wouldn't do that. So maybe this show can reach into the minds of our audience, help us each question our own empathy and our willingness to follow rules, and maybe fit in a good laugh while we're doing it.
That's The Big Red Button at the Matrix Theater in Detroit. Now let's go to Northville, to the Tipping Point Theater, and they're doing a special play they call Every Brilliant Thing. Tell us about that.
Yeah, this is a one-actor play, Lester, that has some audience participation features. So it's a very different experience. Depression is a major force in our society. This is a reality. And sufferers and the people who love them, though, are often apprehensive about discussing. Well, Every Brilliant Thing goes at this subject with a lot of care, wit, and humor confronting the issue, and even gets into the feelings of suicide, the impact of the sufferer on his and her family. But make no mistake, this play is not a bummer, I promise. Even disease and mental illness has its share of humor, and this play accepts that and uses that to its advantage. I've seen it before, and I can tell you that I came out feeling very up and not down. And also, this play, in some of the performances, uses a male actor, and in some, uses a female actor. And this play will run through February at the Tipping Point in Northville.
Now, to the Williamston Theater near Lansing, we have a premiere of Our Lady of Poison. And I heard this is based on a true story.
Yeah, it's written by Michigan's most prolific playwright, Joe Zettelmeyer. It's set in 1659 Rome. Julia Tofana and her daughter are apothecaries. And for those who don't remember their history, that's pharmacists. And they also happen to be very skilled poisoners, which is not a quality you want in your pharmacist, but it makes for a good story. They run in sort of an infamous underground operation to provide wives with an escape from unhappy marriages. I spoke to Joe this week, and here's what he had to say about this play.
It's a play about this woman and her daughter who created and sold this poison, that they sold it to women who wanted out of marriage at a time in which divorce wasn't really a thing. And it just, especially for a modern environment, even though the play is set so drastically in the past, it really deals with how far this woman was willing to go to create justice in a time that was very unjust for women.
This is based on a true story. Joe told us that he stumbled on it while he was working on a whole other play about a Renaissance fair. And he knew immediately that it would make for a good play, and I think it will.
That's Our Lady of Poison at the Williamston Theater. Now, we've heard about nuclear war, suicide, and poisoning, maybe something a little bit more on the lighter side?
Yes. At the Encore Musical Theater in Dexter, we have a familiar musical and crowd pleaser, Million Dollar Quartet.
Well, it's one for the money, two for the show. Three to get ready, now go get on, don't you? Double up.
This is a show that has enjoyed success on Broadway, London, Las Vegas, as a touring show, and more recently in regional theaters around here. It's the story of the one day that Johnny Cash, Elvis Presley, Carl Perkins, and Jerry Lee Lewis all gathered in the offices of Sun Records, where they were all signed. There's an iconic photograph of the four on which the story is based. Nobody was taking notes, but there is tape of the session. And we know what was going on, which was that Cash and Presley were on the verge of bailing out on Sun. Carl Perkins was very angry that Presley recorded his signature song, Blue Suede Shoes. And Lewis was the young upstart who was kind of aggravating Presley and Cash and Perkins. Music is iconic, so if you love the music of the mid-50s and the changes, especially young Presley and Jerry Lee Lewis were ushering in, this is a great show for you.
And lastly, let's talk about improv.
Yeah, I want to spotlight a theater we've not talked about before, and that is Pointless Brewery and Theater. This is in Ann Arbor on Platte Road. It's in a strip mall, and it's an improv theater which also sells craft beer. As most people know, improv doesn't always land well, so the beer helps when that happens. I have been there a couple of times, though, and I can attest that the beer is good. And the improv has been pretty darn good, too. They have a new show going on right now called Cue This. And the way this works is that the host brings up a volunteer from the audience up to spin a genre wheel.
Hopefully somebody who hasn't had too many beers.
Hopefully, yeah. And whatever it lands on, that will dictate the style of the show that the players have to perform next. So the audience chooses the sound and the lighting cues that the actors have to work with all on the fly. No two shows are the same. And this gets very funny in a hurry. It's a hoot and a very different kind of experience than just going to watch a show, you know, kind of unfold in front of you like the ones we've been talking about. And this show plays at the Pointless Brewery and Theater through February 9th.
All right. You can get details on these and other productions around Michigan by going to EncoreMichigan.com. David Kiley of Encore Michigan, thanks very much.
Thanks, Lester.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. There are a lot of bright, accomplished high school students in Detroit who see college as out of reach. They're never told about student aid. They're not aware of courses to help them do well on SAT or ACT tests. Detroit students might not be aware of the Detroit Promise, a program created by Mayor Mike Duggan to set aside tax dollars to fund two-year college scholarships. If only there was a group to help coordinate all the programs and the assistance available to students. Well, actually, there is. It's called the Detroit College Access Network. It's headed up by Ashley Johnson, and she joins us now. Let's start by talking about some of the major obstacles in Detroit. Kids in low-income families and students of color generally don't do as well in school. What's being done to help them overcome these obstacles, the obstacles they face in preparing for college?
Yeah, so I think you already spoke about a couple of those. So there's several obstacles. One is oftentimes when a student is the first in their family to go to college, they don't necessarily have those folks in the family and or maybe in their environment they can go to and ask questions about college. So the general college knowledge and understanding the process and what a FAFSA is and how to complete an application and what classes they should be taking and how to figure out which college is going to be the best match and fit for them. So I would say just sort of college knowledge in general is one.
Let's follow up on that because, you know, if you are the first in your family, that family might have never gone through that experience. So do you help the families understand what's going on as well as a student?
Yes. So our focus is really to build the capacity of the school to create some of these things within the school. So we work primarily with principals and counselors and really help them do things like family nights and really give them kind of the resources they need to have those conversations with families. Ultimately, I think in the city of Detroit, oftentimes we begin this conversation in senior year and it's a little bit too late by then because by then you already have an established GPA and you likely have already taken the SAT a few times. So, you know, we need to begin these conversations much earlier and start these conversations as early as middle school before that transition into high school. But yeah, this is a process that families have to be heavily involved in as well. So it's not just a student conversation, it's certainly a family conversation as well.
The Detroit College Access Network coordinates efforts by a large number of organizations. How do you go about making sure that those efforts are working toward the common goal of getting more Detroit kids prepared for and into college?
So the first thing that we do is we really have all those major organizations come together on what we call a leadership team. We all sit down together and we look at citywide data. So across all 50 of our high schools in the city, no matter if they're DPS, DPSCD, charter schools or private schools, across all those high schools, you know, what is our data telling us? How are we doing? How many of our kids are enrolling? How many of our kids are persisting? And how many of our kids are graduating? And then we set citywide priorities based on that. So as a city, as all of us here, all these organizations at the table, what can we do citywide to really help and improve the outcomes of our students?
As you've done this job, I'm wondering what you found is not working in the effort to get more kids in college.
Oh, wow. Let me say this. I think there were several high schools in the city of Detroit who kind of deemed themselves as magnet and or sort of college prep high schools. But I wouldn't say like traditionally all high schools saw themselves as that. So really helping high schools, no matter what population of students they serve or what neighborhood they're located in or where they are in Detroit, understand they have to create a college going culture. The other thing is probably college is everything post-secondary. So we use the term college, but we really mean trade, certificate, apprenticeship, 2-year, 4-year, whatever the best match and fit is for that student and that family, that's where we really want them to go.
So how do you help the schools help the students prep for college?
So some of the stuff that schools can do early is, one is making sure they have at least one dedicated person in the building who's dedicated to this effort. We call that person a college access champion. And so we ask every high school to kind of identify a person as a college access champion. And then we ask them to start small. Can you start by making sure that every single senior completes one college application? Great. Now can you make sure that every single senior completes the FAFSA? And now can we begin to think about what we need to do with our 9th through 11th graders, so whenever you see them and you're trying to have these hard conversations if you've had for the last year or two with your seniors, they're ready and prepared for that. And so oftentimes schools start kind of with a simple campaign where they're working really hard with those seniors, and then they start backwards mapping that. And some go as far as actually having an entire class dedicated to sort of, you know, what students are going to do post high school.
Some of these kids do really well in school, and then they're faced with the SAT or the ACT test. Those tests, in large part, of course, determine eligibility for scholarships and whether some college will accept you. But not everyone does well on tests. They clutch, you know, even when they have a good handle on the material. So how can you help them get through that?
Well, one is, I think, more exposure to the SAT. Oftentimes, first-generation students think the one time they take it is the end-all, be-all. And we know that's not the truth. We know that, one, they should be taking it multiple times, and two, they should be in high-quality preparation courses, which there's a complete lack of those in the city of Detroit, external of schools, unless the school is actually offering that. And so students may feel like there aren't very many opportunities outside the school. Now, some of the schools are actually offering ACT and SAT prep, but I would say that it's not consistent across the board, and the quality of those SAT, ACT prep classes aren't consistent. But we do have Khan Academy now. And so I know many of the students and families are relying on that. And essentially, Khan Academy has now started working with College Board. So once the students take their SAT, they can actually marry their Khan Academy platform with that. So Khan Academy will give them like sort of individualized support based on the questions they miss on the SAT. So they can utilize that on their own, and that can come to their phone, that can come through, you know, a computer, and they can utilize that to actually improve their SAT scores. But as far as face-to-face, I think that is, you know, we just don't have enough of that in the city of Detroit. So that's one. Two, you know, making the case that they're a well-rounded student. So really utilizing those college essays to kind of tell their story and tell who they are, and maybe explaining some of the issues they've had around test taking. And so helping students understand that the college application process is a holistic process. It's not just dependent upon your SAT and GPA. Although those matter a lot, there's a lot that you can do in a strong college essay.
And those essays are optional usually, right?
They are. And so one is making sure that the kids know they should definitely do the essay. And so that's something that we definitely try to talk to our schools and parents about, is like making sure that you actually complete and do the essay. That's an opportunity for them to actually see who you are beyond the other portions of the college application.
Statewide in Michigan, about 40% of the people between age 25 and 64 have earned a college degree. It says on your data dashboard that the rate of Detroit kids earning any college degree is about 16%. How are your efforts affecting the number of Detroit kids who earn a college degree?
So with things like the Promise and other opportunities, we can kind of see the financial barrier being removed. So we really rely on them to support with sort of the financial barrier that students might face. And we try to dive deeper into the other things, as I say, like college knowledge, understanding what courses you need to take and things like that. Ultimately, there's a lot that can be done in the high school space to make sure that more of our students are not only enrolling, but persisting and graduating. So over time, in the last couple of years, we have definitely seen the number of kids that are enrolling in college from Detroit increasing. One of the issues is once they land on a college campus, they're not actually persisting and graduating. And so that's made us go back and rethink about our efforts. Yes, we are getting more kids into college, but what can we do to make sure that we're getting them into places where they can actually be successful?
One of the things I've heard from community colleges is that these kids aren't ready for community college. They need remedial courses first. So who failed?
Well, I think that's part of the issue, is that we always want to point fingers at one another and say this system failed or that system failed. I think at the end of the day, we got to figure out how to work together. So, you know, if we know that many of our students are coming in needing remedial courses, there's something we can do in their 11th and 12th grade year. As we know, the 12th grade year, students aren't necessarily maxed out with high school credits, but can we use some of that time and energy? They've already taken the SAT. They've already taken these tests where we'll know whether or not they need remedial courses. Can we use that 12th grade year to take care of some of those remedial courses? And in that would actually have higher ed and K-12 working together to kind of, you know, solve those issues. And so I think it's time to kind of move beyond pointing fingers and figuring out, okay, if these are our problems, what are possible solutions that we both can do together?
What would be the most helpful thing the state of Michigan could do to help more kids in Detroit prepare for and attend college?
Wow, that's a great question. I think extending more programs like The Promise. So right now The Promise is 2-year, and I know that they have been working on a 4-year portion of The Promise. I think that would be really, really, really critical.
With state funding.
Yes. I think the other thing would be access to just more rigorous coursework in high school. Across the city of Detroit, we don't have enough AP, IB, honors classes, enough opportunities for students to take really rigorous coursework. And so I think that would be a really, really critical thing so they can have higher test scores on the SAT so they can get into some of the, you know, higher performing higher education institutions across the state.
Ashley Johnson is the executive director of the Detroit College Access Network. Thanks for coming in.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Still to come, a Bridge Magazine reporter outlines the real state of the state. And then we'll talk about the opioid crisis from a transplant surgeon's point of view.
I started to notice how kind of perfect they were, how young they were, what great organ donors they were, and how sad that was.
Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham and for Cynthia Canty. Tonight, Michigan Governor Rick Snyder will deliver his annual State of the State address. Because of term limits, it will be his last. You can hear the speech tonight. You'll hear lots of analysis afterward and on the program tomorrow. But we're not going to talk about that right now. Instead, we're going to hear about a Bridge Magazine article titled, No Offense, Governor Snyder, but Here's Michigan's Real State of the State. Ron French is the reporter behind that, and he joins me now. Hi there, Ron.
Hi, nice to be here.
Cheeky headline, Mr. French.
We try our best.
It's a serious look at Michigan, of course. You start out by writing, we have a steadily improving economy, pay less in taxes than most states, and saw employment grow nearly 10% between 2010 and 2015. That's a nice start, but then the wheels come off. What else does Michigan have?
What we try to do is try to take the sort of partisan positions away from these sort of things and just actually look at the numbers. And some of the numbers are improving, but a lot of them are not. And even the ones that are improving have a long way to go. We have higher poverty rates than the national average. Our schools lag behind most other states in performance. Those who get into college pay more for college than in other states. We smoke more than other states. We binge drink more than most residents of most other states. And that isn't even before we get to talking about the roads.
Yeah, let's go section by section as you dissect this real state in which you find Michigan. First, economic good times, unless you earn a paycheck. What do you mean by that?
Well, the economy has been growing pretty well. In 2016, it grew at 2.2%, which is far above the national average of 1.5%. So that sounds great, right? Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, if you go past 1 year and look over a 10-year period, the national economy is growing at four times the rate of Michigan. And as far as like paychecks, that if you or I are earning paychecks, I don't care what the state economy is. I care how many digits are on my paycheck. The median household income in Michigan is $52,000. That's $5,000 below the national average. That's about 10% below the national average. We rank 34th in that. And I think for people who are actually trying to pay the bills, that's what matters the most.
Your next section asks, what's wrong with our schools? And I think that would take more than a short discussion to cover, but what did you find is wrong with our schools in a nutshell?
Well, you've just looking at the numbers, it's hard to deny we're lagging behind. We rank 41st nationally in fourth grade reading. You go up to eighth grade, we rank 37th in math. I don't think there's any category where they measure these things that we're above the national average. We spend what seems like a lot of money on education, but actually our spending per pupil has dropped 7% in a decade. It's the second worst rate in the nation.
In your next section, you get personal. I mean, you find we smoke, as you mentioned, we drink too much, we are obese, we won't even stay put in Michigan. Explain yourself, sir.
Well, I was surprised by these numbers, although after reading some of these other numbers, I did want to have a drink. But the fact is that we rank 10th in binge drinking, we rank 10th in adult obesity, we rank 11th in our rate of smoking, we rank 16th in violent crime, and it's sort of hard to find some numbers that make us look good in sort of the personal point of view. But and then something that is actually affecting the economy, we have a hard time keeping our people here. More people leave than come here. In the decade between 2007 and 2016, we had the fastest drop in population in the nation. We are starting to see that is starting to turn around a little bit, but when you look past 1 or 2 years, it's not good.
You then turn to infrastructure, which is, as you put it, boring until it's not. Think Flint. With the exception of roads, most of the infrastructure is out of sight, out of mind. What should we be asking candidates about infrastructure in this election year?
Michigan has approximately 460,000 miles of lead service lines. What are you going to do about it? How are you paying for it? The same way with the roads. We are underfunding our crumbling roads and bridges by $4 billion a year. And if I were talking to a candidate, I'd want to know, weigh that against tax cuts, which are being discussed right now. Tell me how you prioritize those two.
Speaking of taxes, the Michigan tax burden for business and residents is relatively low. Where do we rank compared to other states in business taxes?
In business tax burden, which is looking at the taxes we pay as a share of the total state economy, we were tied for the lowest in the nation, which surprised me. I didn't realize that, considering what you hear in public discourse all the time.
I was going to say, you know, all we hear out of Lansing is we need to cut taxes. Our legislative leaders are spending a lot of time trying to figure out a way to lower taxes for business and for us. What's wrong with that?
Well, there's nothing wrong with it. It's a great selling point if you're a politician. And who's going to argue, no, we need to pay more taxes? Well, the problem is, you know, it takes taxes to actually, you know, repave a road or repair a bridge. As far as individual residents, when you stop talking about business, for you and I, the amount we pay per capita in state and local taxes is 17th lowest. So we're again below the national average in how much we pay. So we're not a high tax state.
But we have the impression that we must be, and that government must be way too big in Michigan because we're paying a lot because the legislature tells us we are. Where's the disconnect here?
Well, it's a good message. I mean, you know, if I were a politician, it's kind of hard to, like, get a lot of votes by saying, I am going to increase your taxes. But when you talk about politicians often talk about, we can cut taxes and it won't hurt you because we're going to cut the fat. We're going to decrease the size of government. Well, we have the second lowest ratio in the nation of state and local government employees compared to the general population. So we already don't have many people working for us. So it's kind of hard to cut much fat.
All of these things are known. I mean, you came up with some stats that might not be commonly known, but most of this, we have a general idea, the picture ahead of time, and it won't sound like what Governor Snyder describes tonight. But we don't seem to hear much from our politicians about how we're going to correct some of these things. Why aren't we having these discussions? This is what public policy is supposed to be about, right?
It absolutely is, and that's why we did this, Lester. The public should know that this fall is going to be an unusual opportunity for them. Not only do we elect a new governor, but we elect all 148 state legislators in the House of Representatives and the Senate. It's the first time that's happened since 2010. So we have a great opportunity to make some choices and to hold politicians' feet to the fire. Our hope in putting these sort of numbers out that we put out today is to try to find some common ground in data from which point we can actually have a debate over how to fix Michigan.
Are people going to believe what you found? Because we know that, you know, news reports have less and less credibility these days.
Well, we certainly hope so. I mean, all we can do is just put the numbers out there. These numbers are certainly can be fact-checked. These are actual facts. And then we as an organization of Bridge Magazine are going to be spending a lot of time in 2018 asking politicians over and over again about how they should handle these problems that have been addressed, that we think the public cares about.
Ron French reports for Bridge Magazine. The article is "No Offense, Governor Snyder, But Here's Michigan's Real State of the State." Good to talk to you again.
Thank you.
By the way, you can join us for live coverage of the governor's speech, the Democratic response, and what it all means. That's Governor Rick Snyder's final State of the State address tonight at 7 on Michigan Radio. Recently, I've been reading reports that the number of organ transplants is rising, but the reason is unfortunate. Joining me now is Dr. Michael Inglesby. He's a professor of surgery and associate professor of transplant surgery at the University of Michigan. So first, are these reports right? Are we seeing more organ transplants?
Yeah, in 2016, we did more organ transplants, and there are more organ donors than there had ever been in the United States. So yeah, numbers are going up.
What's the reason for the increase?
I think it's almost completely related to the opioid epidemic. Common kind of causes of death that lead to organ donation historically have been things like trauma, car crashes, but cars are safer than they've ever been. You know, so mortality or fatality from a car crash is lower than
Well, that's
ever
good
been.
Anyway.
Yeah. Yeah, and gun violence numbers are actually down, other common causes. So by far the growth area in organ donation in the United States is people overdosing.
How long has this been going on? How long have you noticed that trend?
The best data that I've seen is from New England. So it's kind of the New Hampshire, Vermont, Maine, and Massachusetts area. In 2010, they kind of received about 4% of their organ donors from overdose. 2015, that number was about 27%. So it's almost, you know, a 7- or 8-fold increase over 5 years. So certainly it has been remarkable. And I've seen that in my day-to-day work.
It's hard to get a handle on just exactly how big this opioid crisis has become. Is Michigan any better or worse as far as you know?
Yeah, I think states hurt the most by the opioid epidemic. Kentucky, Ohio, and New Hampshire. Not far behind are states like Michigan. So any state with a large rural population, we somewhere are between the 10th and 15th most blighted state in the United States regarding overdose. So it's a big problem in Michigan. And I have seen it with respect to people who donate and who I operate on and why they're dead.
This is an odd question, but I have to ask it. You know, you've got recipients of those organs. This must be something of a blessing for them.
Yeah, I think tragedy happens within families, and we see our work as, you know, transplant professionals to try to make some good out of the tragedy. And yeah, we're doing a lot of transplants, and that is saving lives. But absolutely, our interest is saving lives on the transplant end, but also trying to combat this epidemic to try to save lives, because prevention will be key.
Stereotypically, it's a white guy in his 50s who's addicted to opioids. Are those the kind of people you're seeing become donors?
No. These are young people. I think our most vulnerable people are the group of people that are most affected by this epidemic. Just a couple anecdotes. You know, as a transplant surgeon, you go to other hospitals within the Midwest and you essentially operate on organ donors. And in the process of doing that, you don't usually spend a lot of time pondering, you know, kind of their journey and how they got there, because it's just not really conducive to doing the work. But a couple of years ago, I think myself and some of my colleagues have really noticed how common it had been. So in Michigan, about 3 years ago, we started a policy that before we operate on these people and essentially to make an incision in their chest and their abdomen to take out their organs, we pause and we do a checklist, kind of a safety checklist, and then we give thanks. It's kind of a different, it's a unique experience, because you're in the operating room and everything usually moves really fast, and essentially you can't move. And you have to sit there and wait for 30 seconds in silence. And during experiences like that, you do occasionally just ponder how this person got there. And, you know, looking at the donor, I started to notice how kind of perfect they were, how young they were, what great organ donors they were, and how sad that was. At least for me, I have a strong interest in combating the epidemic, and really that is what has motivated my interest, just seeing the tragedy that underlies this story.
We're seeing these kids get hooked on these painkillers, maybe after a dental procedure or a sports injury, something like that. Why aren't we seeing the warning signs of an addiction?
Yeah, it's a great question. As any physician or dentist, I think we all need to pause and kind of ponder our role in this. And so many of the stories of these organ donors started with, as you said, a wisdom teeth removal or, you know, a sports injury in high school. And young people are exposed to opioids and then really it changes their life forever. The warning signs are tough. They're tough to notice. And it really, everyone is at risk. You know, it goes beyond kind of socioeconomics or race. It's really all of us are at risk. So I think the lessons are we as physicians need to be very thoughtful on how we write or prescribe for opioids. And then we need to really talk and work with our patients regarding the best pain care we can possibly give them. And then I think a really important message for your listeners is that if you have opioids in your home, you need to get them out of your home. They really are very dangerous to have in your home, and they can cause really devastating impact on your loved ones and on, you know, people in your community.
So as you saw this, was there a moment where you say, wow?
That's a great question. I can think of a time about 3 years ago when we went to a hospital and we got the liver, and we were coming home. And one of the medical students asked me a lot of questions about the organ donor. And to be honest, as a transplant surgeon, you don't think about their journey very much. You just focus on, you know, taking care of your recipient. And it really made me pause and listen to their questions. You know, they're 25-year-old. It was all new to them. And they were very curious about the 25-year-old I just procured the organs from and how they got from, you know, an injury to their knee in college to overdose. And it really struck me that there's a role I have as a surgeon to kind of make sure at least my patients don't go on that journey and then potentially even do more kind of within the state of Michigan to really try to combat this epidemic.
If they've been addicted to opioids and that caused their death, is there any damage to any of the organs?
Occasionally, people who have history of substance abuse disorder are more likely to have hepatitis and HIV and some of the other diseases. But we obviously screen and test for all that very effectively. As a transplant surgeon, you spend a lot of time talking to your patients about the risks and the benefits. And if you need a transplant, you are willing to take on a lot of risks. If someone overdosed, it may affect their heart or their lungs or their liver, but usually the impact is pretty moderate. And in general, people who overdose tend to be good organ donors. The organs usually work pretty well. When you overdose, usually you stop breathing and your brain dies, but the rest of your organs can kind of thrive, and that's how we are able to kind of use them for transplantation.
Are we beginning to get a handle on this opioid crisis? I've been seeing insurance companies are starting to pass policies to limit what they'll pay for. Doctors are talking about making sure that, you know, instead of handing 50 pills, they hand 8 pills to a patient. On the other hand, I've heard doctors say, look, we just want to make sure they're comfortable. We don't want to lose them as a patient because we wouldn't give them a couple more pills. So are we getting there? Are we getting a handle on this?
I think so. It's a topic that 2 years ago when we started working on it, I think no one was really talking about. And now I think everyone is. And for the first time in my practice, I transplanted a small child, and the parents asked, you know, I don't want my child to get any opioids. I'd never been asked that before in my surgical career. So parents are starting to worry about this. So I do think we're getting a handle. I think physicians are starting to do a better job of taking care of pain. But most importantly, I think to get the word out to the general public about the important role opioids do have in their care, but also the caution that needs to be taken when any patient takes opioids.
Michael Inglesby is a professor of surgery and an associate professor of transplant surgery at the University of Michigan. Thanks for coming in and talking to us about this.
Pleasure.
We want to know what questions you have about Michigan's 911 system. Have you called 911 recently? Can you tell us about your experience? Leave us a voicemail at 734-764-7840 or just go to stateside page at michiganradio.org and share your story there. We'll discuss the state of 911 in Michigan later this week. Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings and engineered by Peg Watson.
Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mike Blank, Joy Horan, Mercedes Mejia, and Lindsay Scullin. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham, and for Cynthia Caddy, thanks for listening.